is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. Getting a divorce is never easy, but it's the 21st century, and mediation without the courts involved is on the rise. So is it a good idea that child custody should be split between both parents, and the idea that divorce as an institution isn't just not so bad, it's actually pretty normal now? The impact of divorce is long-term, and it's widespread. It affects not just the couple, but their kids, their friends, their extended families, and everybody else around them. Well, new research shows that millennials are starting to recognize that divorce and marriage are both serious business, and that's led to a divorce rate and marriage rates that are both dropping. Well, here to talk about divorce in the 21st century is Philip N. Cohen. He's professor of sociology at the University of Maryland, College Park, and he's here with me in the studio. Professor Cohen, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also joining us from NPR New York is Jacqueline Newman, managing partner of the divorce law firm Berkman, Bodker, Newman, and Shine, LLP. She's also author of The New Rules for Divorce, 12 Secrets to Protecting Your Wealth, Your Health, and Your Happiness. Counselor, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great for having you. Professor Cohen, let's start with the big number, because this was surprising. Divorce rates are dropping, and the stat that you always hear, it's like a truism in American culture, you know, half of all marriages end in divorce. Is that true?
Well, it's never quite been true. That is, we've never gotten to a cohort of marriages where 50% of them ended in divorce. We've gotten pretty close, and we are pretty close. And probably a reasonable guess is that somewhere between 40% and 50% of marriages now will end in divorce. But the key thing is that after a peak in the last 20 years or so, it appears to have been declining now for the last 10 years.
Now, we understand that between 2008 and 2016, divorce rates dropped by 18%. That seems like a lot. What's caused the decline?
Well, the baby boom generation are the people who brought us the really high divorce rates.
Thanks.
They are the people who, ironically, were born into that classic, typical, supposedly typical, wonderful family of the 50s. And as soon as they were old enough to get married, they also started getting divorced. They brought us the very high divorce rates that started in the 70s and into the 80s. But as they've aged out, the generations that followed them haven't brought the higher divorce rates with them. And the decline that we report for the last 10 years is driven entirely by younger people, people under age 45. And I think it's mostly related to the fact that people are being more selective in getting married. So they're more likely to be older when they get married, more likely to have college degrees when they get married. So marriage is becoming more selective and divorce is becoming more rare.
Marriage is becoming more selective. Let's drill down. That means you're further along in life, you're more established, you know yourself better, right?
Those are all reasonable. It's hard to say what makes marriage successful, you know, in the big picture. But it's generally the case that people who are more successful in one realm, like careers, education, and so on, are going to be more successful in other things like marriage. And so it's part of our system of inequalities that when it rains, it pours, and the people who are doing well in other realms are also end up doing better in their marriages.
Now, what about people who are not doing well? What about people at the lower end of the income scale, low-income couples? Are their rates higher?
They're more likely to get divorced. They're also less likely to get married.
In the first place.
Yeah.
So the overall marriage rate declining among young people, we mentioned why it drives a lower divorce rate, but the overall marriage rate is lower among all those cohorts, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, baby boomers, the old folks got divorced a lot. They're aging out. The younger millennials are waiting longer and not getting married as much. Maybe they have fewer social mores enforcing marriage. What about the people in between? What about the people who are 50 right now, 58? What's going on with their marriages?
Well, they still have higher divorce rates than in the past. We all have higher divorce rates than the past. I mean, the olden days, the divorce was quite rare. And ironically, what's happened now is divorce has become more acceptable, less stigmatized, less people are against divorce, but less people are also doing it. I think it's really opened up the conversation to something like a good divorce, because we're not so against divorce anymore. People put a very high value on having a really good marriage. That's one of the reasons why they delay marriages. They have a very high expectation for what marriage should be like.
Jacqueline Newman, you're a divorce lawyer. Your practice is based on it. Do you find more people willing to accept the notion of good divorce?
Absolutely. I think there's been a major shift in the way that people view divorce. And something you had mentioned earlier is about mediation. There's something called collaborative law. There's a lot of different things and ways that people get divorced that just didn't exist in the past. So people had this view of, you know, it had to be war and you had to see the inside of a courtroom. And that's just not the case anymore.
Well, divorce rates appear to be down, Jacqueline Newman, but they're occurring regularly. People were saying in our editorial meetings that January is divorce month. I thought that was like some kind of weird Hallmark holiday. I didn't like the sound of it, that somebody had come up with that. But is it true that people get divorced more often this time of year?
Absolutely. January really is divorce month. And the reason being is that more people come in to see a divorce attorneys in January. And if you think about it, they don't want to go through, you know, anything during the holidays. I always say you don't want a summons for divorce in your stocking. So people want to get through the holidays. And then come January, they're in a situation where they want to start information gathering about the divorce process. And they want to basically educate themselves as to what the next steps would be if they don't want to end the year the way they started it.
Mm. So January, they're making moves, maybe the resolution to get out of a marriage that's not working for them. February, March, your business is the peak of the year?
Yeah, usually I'd find that February people digest, and usually it's around the spring that people really move forward in divorce.
Well, one of our listeners called in to share one thing that happened to him and his partner when they had a divorce, made it significantly easier. Here's Travis in Philly.
One thing that happened in my divorce about a year ago that was interesting was my spouse and I went to counseling during the divorce process. And even though we lacked the ability to get into counseling before our marriage was over, we found a way to do that to make the process better when actually divorcing and going through the court system.
Jacqueline Newman, how interesting. They never went to counseling to try to save the marriage, but once it was accepted that it was going to be divorce, counseling helped there. Do you see that frequently?
You know, I do see it, and I think it's excellent. I think it's a great idea because moving forward, especially if there are children involved, you need to learn how to co-parent. So it's really important to try to do everything you can to preserve the relationship post-divorce. But what we usually have involved in is something called divorce coaches, which are therapists trained in divorce. And so a lot of times people will work with divorce coaches going through the divorce, either individually or together, to basically be put in that position to be able to co-parent going forward.
Philip Cohen, we got a bunch of questions about what divorce looks like now. I'll give you one or two. What are the divorce rates for same-sex couples compared to opposite-sex couples? Do we know yet?
We don't know yet. Unfortunately, our system for recording data about divorces is pretty spotty. States record divorces, but they don't report them in any systematic format. So we're left basically with surveys. And so the numbers I was talking about before come from the Census Bureau, which does a giant survey every year. But it hasn't been going on long enough. It doesn't have the level of detail for long enough to answer the question about same-sex marriages.
States record legal divorces, but they don't report them out in a meaningful way?
Right. So we used to have divorce rates compiled by the federal government from data provided by the states. But now a number of key states like California have opted out of that system, and the federal government can't count official divorces anymore. So instead, we rely on these surveys.
And California is a big one. Randy tweeted this. Is the lower divorce rate possibly connected to people living together and breaking up, whereas in earlier eras, those couples would have gotten married and then divorced?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that's happening, we see a rising age at marriage, and most people have lived together before they get married. And so we don't necessarily have fewer breakups altogether, but we have more breakups occurring before marriage.
Had so many friends not married but have lived with someone broken up and said, you know, it just feels like a JV divorce, which is really, according to the data, what it was. We're talking about how to navigate divorce in the 21st century, speaking with Jacqueline Newman, divorce attorney from New York. Also, Philip Cohen, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland in College Park. Maybe we could use a University of Marriage. We're going to talk more about divorce in the 21st century after the break. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now, Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
The world is complicated, but knowing the past can help us understand it so much better.
That's where we come in. I'm Rand Abdel-Fattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
Well, divorce is a lot of things on a lot of levels, but one thing it definitely is a legal break. So in that regard, what's a big thing that's changed about divorce versus, I don't know, 30 years ago?
So one of the biggest things I'm seeing is really the change in the custody. So back in the day, I think that it was probably presumed that mom would get custody and dad would have every other weekend and the Wednesday dinners. And that's just not the case anymore. Now you have many more fathers who want to be involved. They want 50-50 access time with their children. And courts are supporting this because it's very important to courts that children have both parents involved. It's just a major shift in the way that courts are looking at custody.
What's the difference between a divorce that's a case that's mediated in court, I guess decided in court versus mediated outside of court? Is it best to avoid court simply on the basis of cost? Are there substantive differences between those two routes?
They're completely different processes. So ultimately, you know, I'm a big advocate of trying to keep things out of court if you can. That said, you know, the strategic part of me does acknowledge the fact that sometimes, you know, court, it is important to go to court, and sometimes the court can provide relief that you can't get otherwise. But ultimately, when you're working in mediation, you're working with one person who's a mediator, who's a neutral, and usually the couple will have attorneys on the outside, meaning that they're not usually in the sessions. Mediation, it's a great process if you can do it. It's somewhat self-selecting. It doesn't work for everyone. But ultimately, if you can resolve things in mediation, like for an example, if you're able to resolve custody in mediation and you have to litigate for the finances, I still tell people I think that's better. Ultimately, you're saving yourself hundreds of thousands of dollars possibly in legal fees, and I always say also in therapy bills.
You can split it up. In other words, you can do part of the divorce in mediation, part of it in court if you need to. Is court usually reserved, if you're doing it right, for like the really acrimonious cases, like you can't stand to look each other in the face, you get nothing, you'll have to fight me for every last thing, even the tires on the car, so you got to go to court?
I mean, usually if you have that kind of sort of situation, you probably will end up in court. But the thing that I think about, the thing about court that most people don't recognize is that, first of all, people think they're going to go and they're going to, you know, the judge is going to be so angry at your spouse for doing X, Y, Z. And that just doesn't happen. They think they're going to get their quote unquote day in court. And you don't get your day in court. And the court is incredibly expensive. It's a slow process. And, you know, it's an incredibly frustrating process. Again, sometimes you don't have options, because if one person opts to be in court, you're both in court. I mean, that's the way it works.
You mentioned child custody briefly, and some people have been contacting us on this basis. There used to be a perception that courts really favored women when it came to child custody. And there are men's groups out there now lobbying at the state level to try to change custody laws because they believe those laws are tilted toward women. Is it still the case?
I mean, I think that it's shifting. And I think, you know, what I tell people is that in, say, 5 to 10 years, it's going to be the burden of the spouse who's saying it should not be 50-50. Does that exist right now? Probably not. But again, you know, I've had clients, you know, 10 years ago, I had a client who came in and he, you know, didn't see his children that often during the week. He worked a ton, loved his children, wanted to spend a lot of time with them. And the court basically said, you know what, we're not going to give you know, more and more access than you would normally have had, because that's not historically what's happened for these children. And now when I have clients that come in that are men that maybe are not as involved in the day-to-day caretaking because of the fact they work and maybe their wives take that major role, they now say, you know what, I'm going to switch my career around, or I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to make myself available. And courts are supporting it. They're saying, listen, we'll do everything we can to try to support both children being as involved, both parents being as involved as possible with their children. So I am seeing a great, great shift.
David tweeted us to say that marriage should be a renewable contract. First time you sign up for a one-year term, 6 months out, both parties declare an intention to renew. Otherwise, it simply dissolves. Form a benefit corporation for your family's shareholders. Now, talk about unromantic, but does that logic make any sense to you?
You know, I had a friend once who used to say that every morning I wake up and decide if I want to be married. And, you know, there's some truth to that, because if you really did want to get divorced, as we said, you know, it's possible to do. Whether you actually have to document it, I don't know about that. But conceptually speaking, every day everybody makes a decision.
Yeah, that contract exists. It's just in your mind, if not on paper. I want to bring in Liz Lenz now. Liz, you're here because you've been through a divorce and you've written a lot about it, including a viral essay in Glamour magazine. It was called, "I'm a Great Cook. Now that I'm divorced, I'm never making dinner for a man again." Liz Lenz, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Why was it important for you to write about your experiences and write about it so publicly?
Well, I think that even though we're in 2020, there is still like a cone of silence around divorce and the divorce process. After I wrote about that, I had so many women reaching out to me, talking to me about their own marriages, about their own divorce processes. And so many people are just so afraid of saying, here's the ugly truth, because even now, divorce is still seen as a failure. And I want to shift the conversation and talk about how divorce can be a sign of success, of two people saying, this isn't working, and trying to find something better.
We got this from C. Boom on Twitter. "I divorced after 23 years. My ex and I are the best of friends, but couldn't be our best selves when we were married. We love each other and focus on being the kind of humans for our grown daughter. It's not easy, but it's better than when we were married." Liz Lenz, I would guess that that statement means a lot to you.
It does. And I think so many people say, oh, they don't want to divorce for the kids. But I wanted to divorce for my kids because I wanted my children to see what it was like to have a mother who was happy and successful and had a career. And those were not things I could be while I was still married.
Oh, but Liz, there are a lot of people listening now who are having this feeling. This is all moral relativism. This is younger people taking the easy way out. In my day, marriage, you were in it, you stayed in it, and it meant something. It was a dissoluble contract, whether that's in the church or not, and everybody's just taking the easy way out now, and it's bad for families.
You know, it's not bad for families. I'll tell you what's bad for families. It's seeing two parents constantly in crisis and conflict, and that's what's bad for families. And, you know, anybody who's been through a divorce will tell you it is not the easy way out. Keeping it together, keeping your temper in check, to go through a mediation process when there's like history of hurt. I was married for 12 years, you know, and that is not the easy way out. And anybody who's been through that can tell you, I don't think it is moral relativism. I think it's defining new success, new ways of understanding what's a productive relationship. And I think we need to have these conversations. I've had a lot of older women talk to me quietly who have said, you know, I wish maybe I had done that when I was your age, gotten out while I could. But, you know, now we've been married for 40 years, so it might be a little too late. But, you know, I think happiness is a choice. And I think the more you empower people to make that choice, the better off they're going to be. Like we talked earlier, divorce rates are declining, so are marriage rates. So when you give people choices and say you're empowered to be happy, then they're going to make the best possible choices for their lives.
Now, you were married for 12 years. How old were you when you got married?
I was 22.
Ooh, that's, yeah. I mean, do you look back on that and think that that was, I don't necessarily want to call it a mistake. I wasn't inside your marriage, but was that one of the factors you think that contributed?
Well, I'm a lot different than my millennial cohorts. I was raised deeply, deeply conservative in Texas. You know, we were homeschooled and wore the jean jumpers. And for me and my life, waiting until I graduated from college to get married was a huge deal.
Wow.
It was, you know, it was really radical. I had a lot of people in my life saying, oh, just get married now. And I was like, no, this education's important to me. This is what I really value in my life. And so, you know, I think it's a matter of perspective, right? If that's how you're raised, then 22 is not an early age to get married. I wouldn't call my marriage a mistake. I don't think anybody would call their marriage a mistake, but it's life is a journey, to use the cliche. We're all on it. And, you know, it's important that we keep our life and our experiences in context. I have two wonderful children, and we work really hard to co-parent them despite our differences.
Well, let's hear from Alex, speaking of being conservative and getting married young and getting divorced.
My name is Alex, and I live in New Mexico. I went to a really conservative Christian college in Virginia, and I saw a lot of my friends and classmates. They were getting married at 18, some at 17, but almost everyone before 20. At the time, I felt fairly jealous and left out. But as the years have gone on, as the last decade has passed, I see so many of them getting divorces. And instead of being critical of that, I watch them on things like social media and in times that I've been able to interact with them in person, becoming whole new people, having this opportunity to actually experience their young adulthood in a way that allows them to pursue education and pursue their careers. And a lot of them have done it in sort of this new, amicable way. They're still friends with their exes. And I really think that that's a great development for our culture.
We have a lot more to come after a quick break. More advice on what to do before divorce, during divorce, and most importantly, after a divorce. We're going to hear from our experts, and we're going to hear a lot more from you in just a moment. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
NPR's Code Switch is a podcast about race in America that's about all of us. Our histories, how we're represented, the ways we've worked together and worked against each other. You'll learn, you might get mad, you'll definitely laugh, but don't take my word for it. Just listen to NPR's Code Switch.
Back to our conversation on divorce in America with attorney Jacqueline Newman, professor of sociology Philip Cohen, and writer Liz Lenz about the impact of divorce on today's couples and their families. Professor Cohen, we were talking before the break about young marriage and rates of divorce. What do we know?
Well, time was in the 50s and 60s, almost everybody got married before age 25, and divorce was almost unheard of. So you have very low rates of marriage when low rates of divorce when divorce is basically not allowed. But now that divorce is allowed, we find that the highest risk of divorce is among people who get married at young ages, before age 25 or even younger. And I think one reason for that is that our early adulthood is longer, takes longer to grow up now. People spend more time getting to finish their education, going to college and whatnot. And I find a lot of my students, especially women in my classes, who want to delay marriage until after they finish their education because they want to enter the marriage on an equal footing with their future spouse. And you can't really do that at a very early age because you don't know where you're going to end up.
And is young marriage an anomaly now? I mean, if you're 19 and getting married today, do your cohort, your friends, people in your age group think that's weird?
I wouldn't say weird. It's very unusual. Mm. So the average age marriage is up around 28 for women, a little higher for men. And people getting married in their early 20s has become quite uncommon.
Talk a little bit more about the impact of income on divorce rates. You mentioned that low-income people have higher divorce rates. Break it down a little bit, what we know about income strata, about annual salary or just assets, and what that means to whether people get married in the first place and then stay together.
Well, we find that people who have higher incomes or higher education are more likely to get married, although ironically, they sort of need marriage less, especially in the case of women. What used to be that women would marry a man with a higher income to increase their own income or assets. That's less the case now, but it's still true that people with higher income and education are maybe more desirable in the marriage market, so to speak, or also more able to get what they want out of the dating scene. And so it's flipped in the last few decades, where people with higher education and income are now more likely to get married instead of less likely.
Jacqueline Newman, here's a note from Michael that I think you could help with. Michael says, my wife has health issues. We're considered low income. She gets SSI based on my income. I can't afford to insure her and continue to pay the bills. We've been told that if we divorce, she would qualify for Medicaid. A lot of our friends and relatives have divorced under similar circumstances. We love each other, but we may have to divorce to get her health issues addressed. Is this something you see?
You know, I don't see it all that often. I will acknowledge I generally deal more in the high net worth space, but I do see people that sometimes are trying to get divorced to avoid debt situations. I mean, it's probably not common. I wouldn't say it's more common, but it definitely does happen. And, you know, people will do things to try to kind of work the system, shall we say, if they have to.
Philip Cohen?
I think those cases are more likely on the margins. I don't think the financial or legal tax benefits or penalties are really driving the bulk of marriage and divorce decisions. But you do see in the marginal cases where there may be a particular benefit or a particular debt problem where you find the divorce may be affected. One place you actually see this more often is in second or third marriages where people have complicated family history and they may be trying to protect assets. They may not want to get into a second or third marriage because they're trying to protect their children's access to their assets. And those situations get much more complicated.
There was a time in recent American history, and it wasn't all that long ago, when there was a great deal of moralizing from politicians about the importance of marriage, the institution of marriage, and fashioning government so that it promoted marriage. And these low-income people are talking about the exact opposite. They're talking about laws and rules when it comes to benefits like Medicaid and SSI for poor people, for disabled people, that mean the exact opposite.
Well, there has been a long campaign by the federal government to try to promote marriage, and it's part of our welfare policy now to promote marriage on the theory that if people got married, they wouldn't need help from the state. Marriage was sort of a system for paying for that labor, which was not remunerated in the labor force. You know, if no one's going to pay you to do housework and childcare, the marriage was a way to use some of the man's income to pay for that labor. That system is breaking down, you know, largely, which is mostly good. But we do find that one of the reasons that divorce disadvantages women more than men is because men still earn more than women. When they do separate, the woman is more likely to end up with a lower income and also probably more likely to still end up with the children. Mm-hmm. So there's still a gender inequality that runs throughout the marriage and divorce system.
Well, let's talk about alimony. Jacqueline Newman, Lisa emails to ask, what is the formula for alimony? For example, the wife never graduated from college and stayed home for 30 years, and the husband earns $300,000.
So it varies very much from state to state. And now that you can no longer deduct alimony, there's been a change in the tax laws that you can no longer deduct alimony from the payor, and it used to be income to the payee, it has actually made the gap even larger about how you're going to negotiate spousal support, alimony, things like that. So the formulas really vary. I couldn't even begin to start. It's a complex formula. It would take the rest of this show. But there are formulas. Every single state is different in the way that they handle it. But I can just tell you that it's becoming harder and harder to resolve because of the facts that the tax consequences.
Interesting what you just said, though. Alimony used to be a write-off for the payor and income for the payee, meaning you have to pay income tax on it. All that is gone now. It's neither a write-off nor income?
From a federal standpoint, the states are, you know, can handle it differently. But it really has impacted, as I said, the negotiations, because usually if you do have a situation like was just described, where you have one person who's in a zero tax bracket and then you have someone who's in a higher tax bracket, that to be able to play that off from a financial standpoint was, you know, really significant in our negotiations. And now that's all gone.
Well, we got a message from one of our listeners who called to talk about her amicable divorce. It went so smoothly, in fact, that there were no lawyers involved.
This is Mish, and I'm from Ann Arbor. I got divorced about 10 years ago, and we were very good at communicating what we needed and wanted out of the divorce. So we didn't hire an attorney. I did all of the paperwork. It was a lot of work to try to figure that all out. And we got divorced together and making it the best experience we could for our kids. And it's a doable thing. We just need the resources to figure out how, rather than going the traditional route and creating all kinds of tension and craziness with attorneys on both sides.
Jacqueline Newman, this sounds wonderful, I think, to the rest of us. I'm not sure that this DIY approach sounds so advisable to you, or am I wrong?
Well, you know, I call it the kitchen table talks. So I do have many clients that say, you know what, I can figure out some of this. And so usually in situations like that, I say, great, if you two can sit down at the kitchen table and figure things out, I think that's fantastic. However, you need to know what you're talking about. So as we said, a lot of times people come to me in January and they want to kind of just get the roadmap of what divorce looks like. You know, and again, in my book, I kind of talk a lot about like the real basics of what you should know. And then if you are in an educated position, then I think, you know, great. If you can sit and have that conversation and there's not a huge power imbalance and you think you can really both be on the same page about trying to do everything you can to protect your family and to protect your children going forward, I think it's fantastic. I just don't know if it always works.
Yeah, it may not work for everybody. Well, Barb emails this. How does a person find the right lawyer for them? I'm in a situation right now, and I have no idea besides asking Google. I'm very private. I don't want to ask around. There has to be a better way.
Yeah, it's an issue. I mean, I think it's one of the biggest questions that people do ask me is, how do I know who's my right attorney? Especially if you are private. I mean, a lot of people do look on the internet. You know, you do need to be careful about that. But, you know, if you can, if there are people that you could speak to, I think that that's always the best way, because you want someone who's actually experienced working with this attorney. But, you know, we get a lot of people that find us on the internet and then, you know, and then do, I would definitely recommend doing initial consultations, because again, you need to make sure you're comfortable with that person.
Liz Lenz, in addition to writing repeatedly about divorce in magazines and websites across America, I know you got a lot of friends and I know they come to you. What are some of the things that your friends of similar ages have said to you about their divorces and when they talk to you as the expert?
Well, I think something that you realize is, you know, no marriage is the same and nobody understands a relationship, you know, from the outside. And even people on the inside might not even understand the relationship. And while every break is different and complicated, there's a couple things that I think especially women need to always consider is, you know, what are their rights? And how can they find emotional support? And to that person who, you know, was asking for how do I find a lawyer, I'd say first get a therapist and then get a lawyer, because my therapist pointed me to a lawyer, and that I think has made all the difference. And finding a good support system. Again, I think a lot of privacy comes from shame. And we don't need to feel that anymore. There's truly nothing to be prouder about than reclaiming your life and reclaiming your happiness. And that should not be a process that's shrouded in shame.
Well, Liz, I want to make sure we get Donna in here before we go. Donna emails to say, my parents, quote, celebrate their 60th anniversary this year. They've spent their lives miserable. And it's cost me years of therapy and doubt when I wish they had divorced when I was in high school, when they threatened to, and I wish they would still get divorced today. So much is said about the effect of divorce on children, but divorce has an effect on the happiness of people around them. So many unhappy marriages that stay together don't need to.
One of my friends, when I was in the throes of misery with my marriage, and I was like, no, I'm just going to stay. I'll just sleep in the guest room and we'll make it work. And she was like, you don't have to play chicken with your life. Your life is not a game of chicken. You don't have to see who's going to flinch first, who's going to be miserable first. You can make the choice to be happy. And I think that, again, that's something that is still really radical, even in 2020. And I hope it's one of the reasons I talk about it so openly. And I hope more people do, too.
And that's a positive note and a good place to end. Before we do, Professor Cohen, future trends. We've talked about the current trends in divorce. Where's this going in America?
It's very likely that the divorce rate is going to continue to fall, at least for the next decade or so. Just if we look at the people who've gotten married in the last 10 years, they're showing more and more of the more resilient profile, the higher education, later age at marriage. And so divorce rates are almost definitely going to keep falling.
Divorce rates falling, expected to fall even more. That's Professor Philip N. Cohen, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland in College Park. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Jacqueline Newman is the managing partner of the divorce law firm Berkman, Bodker, Newman & Schein, author of The New Rules of Divorce, 12 Secrets to Protecting Your Wealth, Your Health, and Your Happiness. Jacqueline Newman, a lot of practical advice and a lot of notes from listeners. So thank you very much for the lessons.
Thank you for having me.
We really appreciate it. And Liz Lenz is a writer and a columnist and one heck of a radio guest from the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Liz, great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This conversation was produced by Stacia Brown and edited by Matthew Simonson.
To learn more about the team, visit the website, the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.